Support for the Front Row on FM 89.1 comes from the Community Foundation of West Texas and from Citibank. Citibank's wealth management team of advisors, private bankers, and trust officers help customers create personalized strategies to help connect with long-term goals. More information on Citibank Wealth Management is available at 806-687-2955. And from Texas Tech's J.T. and Margaret Talkington College of Visual and Performing Arts. Vast opportunities abound in art, music, theater, and dance. Dean Noel Zoller invites you to enjoy some of the 800 performances and exhibits produced each year by vastly talented students, faculty, and visiting artists. Texas Tech's J.T. and Margaret Talkington College of Visual and Performing Arts. Vastly different. The Institute for the Study of Western Civilization has hosted a lecture by one of the world's foremost economists studying the war on poverty. We'll have an interview and all the details on today's show. I hope you can stay tuned. On today's edition of The Front Row, we have as our very special guest in the studio, Dr. James Sullivan, who is Gilbert F. Schaefer College Professor of Economics at the University of Notre Dame and is the co-founder of the Wilson Sheehan Lab for Economic Opportunities. Dr. Sullivan is here in town to give a lecture here at Texas Tech University. Dr. Sullivan, welcome. Glad you're here. Thanks for being on the show with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you are a nationally known authority on economics and particularly on poverty and the state of poverty. And in fact, your lecture is called How Has America Fared in Its War on Poverty? Just to begin with, when did the war on poverty begin?
Yeah, we typically date the start of the war on poverty to President Johnson's State of the Union address in 1964, when he formally declared the war on poverty. And what came out of the policy agenda shortly after that State of the Union address was a series of large federal programs that were designed to strengthen the social safety net and improve outcomes for vulnerable populations.
So at the time, this was considered a problem that needed to be addressed.
That's right. Our origins of our poverty measure in the United States date back to that time. The Johnson administration realized that in order to determine whether or not you're going to win the war on poverty, you have to have a metric to measure. And so the first poverty rates measured in around that time in 1964 were close to 1 in 5 individuals in the United States were considered poor.
At that time, was there demographic information that went with it, certain segments of the population, ethnicities, things like that?
That's right, because it was part of the data that the census collected on households, both the demographic information and income information. And one thing, if there was a particular demographic group that stood out at the time, it was the elderly. Poverty rates for those 65 and over were over 25% in the mid-1960s.
So when the war on poverty was implemented, what at that time was the solution? What did they suggest to do?
So there were a series of programs that the Johnson administration passed, got through Congress, and they really make up a bulk of the social safety net that we have today. There are programs like the food stamp program, which is now known as SNAP, started shortly after the war on poverty began and scaled up nationally in the early 1970s. The Medicaid program that provides health insurance to low-income households and individuals. The Head Start program, which provides early childhood child care and child education to low-income families, launched in the late 1960s. And so these were a package of programs that were really the core to this war on poverty.
Well, the title of your lecture is How Has America Fared in Its War on Poverty? So tell us what you think.
Yeah, so one of the most common ways that we assess the war on poverty is to look at the official poverty measure in the United States. And if you look at that poverty measure, poverty rates today, which are about 12%, are actually higher than they were in the early 1970s. And so based on that metric alone, the conclusion has been that we've lost the war on poverty. In 1988, Ronald Reagan, in his State of the Union address, famously said, "We waged a war on poverty and poverty won." And that was the perception in the late 80s, and it still has been the perception today that because the official poverty rate has not noticeably moved down, that these programs must not have been successful. And what I show in my work is that that conclusion is based on a measure that has well documented flaws. These aren't flaws that I've uncovered myself. These are actually well understood. They were featured in a National Academy of Sciences report in the mid-1990s. It just is fairly complicated politically to change the way we measure poverty. And as a result, we have not changed the official measure, even though changes to this official measure would dramatically change our understanding of what's happened as a result of the war on poverty.
So that was where I was going with this. How hard is it then to say this doesn't work and we need to do something else? And what other options are there?
Yeah, so let me start with the kind of general conclusion about have we won the war on poverty, or that we've lost the war on poverty based on the official measure. One of the big shortcomings of the official measure is that it is based on what we call pre-tax money income. So think about it as cash income. And the reason why that's a problem is, let's go back to the programs I mentioned that were part of core to the war on poverty. Food stamps, which is a voucher, not cash, so it's not counted in the measure of resources for poverty. Medicaid is health insurance, so it's not counted as cash. So by the official measure, those programs can't have an impact on poverty because they're not incorporated into our measure. And so the fact that these core components are not part of the measure means that the official measure misses much of the contribution that the war on poverty has made for vulnerable families.
So as part of your work as an economist, do you look for alternatives, better ways to measure, or better programs? What all do you do?
That's right. So my work has looked at, let's incorporate these well-known shortcomings in the official measure into a measure so that we can understand better what the effect of the war on poverty has been. And so, for example, you can calculate poverty by comparing money income plus the value of food stamps and incorporate the benefits from health insurance into the measure of well-being, and then therefore capture the effects of these programs. And when you do that, you see that poverty rates have fallen over time. And the story is actually very different. That once you make the adjustments to address the well-known flaws in the official poverty measure, the evidence is pretty clear that poverty rates have declined noticeably over time. And the conclusion, a much more accurate conclusion, is that maybe I would stop short of saying we've won the war on poverty, but we are in fact winning the war on poverty, that we've made progress in improving the economic circumstances of the most disadvantaged families.
How are the different demographics different today than they were in the mid-1960s?
Well, one of the groups that has benefited the most from expansions in the social safety net has been the elderly. So as I mentioned, the poverty rates for those 65 and over was amongst the highest of any demographic group back in the 1960s. And today, if you account for some of the shortcomings in the official poverty measure, it's very clear that the poverty rates for the elderly are amongst the lowest of any demographic group. Now, why is that the case? What have we done? Over the past 4 to 5 decades, we have expanded the generosity of the Social Security program. And it's pretty straightforward to show that the Social Security program has played a really important role in improving the economic circumstances of disadvantaged elderly individuals.
Right. What ideas do you have going forward should be incorporated into the current system that we have?
Yeah, so there, you know, even though my story is ultimately a good one, which is that, you know, the economic circumstances of disadvantaged populations have improved over time, that's a far cry from saying that, you know, the economic circumstances are great at the bottom, right? There's still, this isn't to say that there aren't plenty of people out there who are struggling to make ends meet and face a lot of challenges. And so I think an important role of policy is to address the new challenges that low-income families face today that might be different from in the past. There's a much greater emphasis on promoting work amongst the along with the social safety net programs in the United States. So, for example, we've added work requirements in order to be eligible for some programs, and there are time limits for receiving cash welfare in the United States now. And those changes have been designed to encourage work amongst vulnerable populations. But these populations often face challenges to gaining stable employment and maintaining a job when also dealing with many other complications like, having a child or, raising kids in a single parent family or other challenges. So it's going to be critically important for policymakers to do a couple of things. One is to increase the returns to work, right? So that those who are working can actually earn enough to maintain self-sufficiency and not be in poverty. One viable policy that the government can support would be what they call the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is a subsidy that increases the earnings of low-wage workers. And it's tends to be a policy that is bipartisan because it both supports the low-income, the bottom part of the income distribution, but it also has been shown to encourage work. So policies like that to increase the returns to work can be quite helpful for reducing poverty or improving well-being at the bottom. But even in that case, there are these challenges with a rapidly changing labor market that many individuals see their skills become obsolete because the jobs have changed. Maybe those jobs have gone overseas. Maybe those jobs have been displaced by technology. So providing the infrastructure or resources to help low-skilled workers retrain, gain access to a new skill set that would allow them to maintain stable employment is going to be critically important for a viable social safety net.
Texas is a border state, mm-hmm. and of course, immigration has been highly in the news now for quite a while. What does immigration and what part does that play going forward? How does that influence your work?
Now, that's a really important question because there have been a lot of concerns that the immigrants who come to this country, a large fraction are coming from Mexico, Central and South America. They tend to be of lower skill. And so then the question is, if you increase the supply of low-skilled labor in this country, are you then pushing down wages for low-skilled individuals in this country? So there have been often been speculation that immigration could be playing a role in keeping wages down for, say, low-educated or low-skilled workers in this country. And so economists have looked into this quite a bit, and there's a pretty rich literature on this. And the consensus is that it's somewhere between no effect and a small negative effect on wages, and in that the real challenge for low-skilled workers in this country is not immigrants. What it is changing technology. Mm. And the changing technology has made it harder to have and maintain a high-paying, low-skilled job. And that is a challenge for policymakers because it's not going to be a very attractive policy to say, well, let's get rid of technology, right? Because technology brings tremendous benefits as well. So that points us again back to this idea of how do we help low-skilled workers adapt and change as the labor market changes.
What difference does it make that the idea that is out now that we want to bring jobs back to America and that we want to be less global in our dealings with our fellow countries and mm-hmm. things like that? How does that affect poverty here in the United States and your work?
So the first point I should make is that bringing jobs back to America is really hard. There's a reason why they left, right? And economic forces are at play here in a way that are very difficult to counteract. So we have exported a lot of manufacturing jobs overseas. Labor is much cheaper in China and elsewhere. And it simply would be too difficult to bring those jobs back in a way that would be affordable and allow us to manufacture products that could be competitive on a global market. So the idea of bringing jobs back, I think we can fight it for a little while, but that's a fight we will almost surely lose because of the power of economic forces. So what can you do then? And so there, again, I think you want to invest in providing the training and skills so that low-skilled or low-income individuals can find a stable and secure job in today's labor market. There are certain jobs that are not likely to be exported or can't be exported. You know, think of jobs in healthcare and services. And some of those jobs are having a difficulty finding enough workers to fill their positions. And so there's a clear mismatch between the current set of skills that individuals have and the needs in the labor market. And additional training could address that gap.
Dr. Sullivan, you have been here at Texas Tech to deliver a lecture on the state of the war on poverty and how America has fared. Anything in that lecture that we've not gotten to that you would like to speak to on the air today to our listeners?
So let me make a couple of other points that we didn't cover. One is that I want to be clear that although there is really good evidence that we're winning the war on poverty, that point, the main point there is that we've made progress over time at improving the well-being of those at the bottom of the distribution. That's not to say that our work is done. And one of the things that any economy faces as it grows is the question, should our standard of what it means to be poor be changing over time? And so, for example, if you go back in time to, say, 1900, virtually everybody in the United States would fall below our poverty line. And I could venture to say that most people back then wouldn't say they were poor. Why? Because our understanding of what it means to be poor was very different back then. As our economy has grown, our understanding of what it means to be poor has changed and probably should change. And that means that the way we measure poverty should probably be adjusted on occasion to account for the fact that our standard of living as a high-income country should be rising over time.
Dr. James Sullivan is the Gilbert Schaefer College Professor of Economics at the University of Notre Dame, and he is the co-founder of the Wilson Sheehan Lab for Economic Opportunities. Dr. Sullivan, thank you very much for carving out some time to be with us on the front row. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Today's edition of our program will be on our website, kttz.org, later today. Rachel Boyd produces The Front Row. I'm your host, Clint Barrick. Thanks for tuning in and listening. Support for The Front Row comes from the Lubbock Symphony Orchestra announcing the 2019-2020 season. More information is at lubbocksymphony.org.